This episode is made possible by Awin. Unlock unlimited marketing opportunities that reach consumers everywhere using Awin's affiliate partnerships platform. Choose which partners best match your marketing objectives, control your costs by defining how you pay, and customize your affiliate marketing program using Awin's tech to mirror your unique goals, whatever they may be. Visit awin.com/emarketer to learn more and get started today.
Even in the short term, I think there could be a ramp of acceptance of this technology, and that it wouldn't necessarily be the consumer and the consumer concerns holding it back. I think it would actually become the Amazon, you know, competition rationale.
Hey gang, it's Tuesday, August 29th. Yuri and listeners, welcome to the Behind the Numbers Daily, an eMarketer podcast made possible by Awin. I'm Marcus. Today I'm joined by one of our principal analysts who covers everything technology based out of New Jersey. It's Yuri Wormser.
Hey Marcus, how are you?
Hey fella. Very good, sir. How are you?
I'm doing fine.
You just came back from my vacation, so you must be doing very well. Yuri did exactly what I wanted to do on vacation, and I'm so jealous, so happy for him. So he's got that fresh-faced look about him. Give it an hour, and you'll be as disheveled as the rest of us. So I've got a fact of the day for you, Yuri, and it's New Jersey specific, and that's where you're based. So the Atlantic City Boardwalk in New Jersey is not only the world's oldest boardwalk, but also the world's longest. Did you know this?
I did not know that, no.
Have you been?
I have never been to Atlantic City, really.
No. Yuri. That's probably most people. But it opened in 1870 and has the length of approximately 5.5 miles. The first casino in Atlantic City was built in 1978, called the Resorts International. Today, it is called Resorts Atlantic City. I went once. I don't need to go twice. No offense, Atlantic City. There's just so many places to see.
Bad memories or?
I just did it, you know? You know when you've done it?
Yeah.
Yeah. I might go back.
Been there, done that.
Exactly. America's too big. There's too many things to see. That's my excuse. Anyway, today's real topic, the many faces of Amazon. So in today's episode, in the first half, me and Yuri will talk about Amazon's TV and voice ambitions. And then in the second half, I'll be checking in on Amazon payment initiatives with Grace and David. But we start with the first half. And so we're talking about Amazon in this episode, but we're not talking about what we would normally talk about when it comes to Amazon. So Amazon, some of the major parts of Amazon's business are kind of common knowledge at this point. The company dominates online shopping. It's got about 40% share of the market in the US. They've got Amazon Web Services, its cloud offering, AWS. It's incredibly profitable for the company. It makes actually made about over $5 billion in profit for the company in Q2 alone. They're also the third largest digital ad player in the US behind Google and Meta. But what is lesser discussed is that Amazon also plays in healthcare, gaming, video, e-readers, smart doorbells, et cetera, et cetera. And so, Yuri, you were part of a team who put together the Power of Amazon report, which we just put out, and about 10 folks, I believe, contributed to that. And you, unsurprisingly, worked on the technology pieces. And so we're going to talk about that in the first half. We'll start with the voice element. You wrote a chapter on voice, writing that voice connectivity sits at a crossroads. Talking about voice because Amazon has Alexa, and it has, which is the voice assistant, and it has Echo smart speaker devices. So that's its play. But Yuri, yeah, you're right that voice connectivity sits at a crossroads. How so? How come?
Yeah, well, I mean, when we wrote this report in 2021, Alexa was just at the heart of everything that Amazon was doing. It was within the speakers. It was situated within their car systems, within Fire TV. Amazon was moving to build hardware that would support Alexa and serve as a portal to commerce and to the internet. That didn't quite work out the way that Amazon had hoped, in the sense that people just don't use their smart speakers or their voice assistants too much to buy things. And it hasn't really translated it into an easy way to make money. So in that sense, it's down from 2021. But something else happened in the past in the interim, and that was ChatGPT and generative AI. And that is a really transformative event, I think, for everyone, including for voice assistants. And it's transformative because voice assistants could be transformed into something a lot more useful, a lot more monetizable, using these more advanced language models.
Okay. So, yes, so that was my question before we hit record, which was, so you know that Amazon needs to move quickly to maintain Alexa as a voice assistant leader. So my question being, will another chatbot device like a ChatGPT overtake Amazon's Alexa in terms of usage? But so for the audience and for myself again, can we compare the two? Is Amazon's Alexa the same as ChatGPT?
Well, they're not the same, but they're definitely, they're related to each other. So Alexa is an assistant. It is a bot that is voice generated. ChatGPT's text, but it can be translated into voice using other languages. But so a large language model would power a voice assistant. So they're both powered by large language models, but they have slightly different purposes.
Okay, got it. And so what happens in a couple of years? Is it going to be the case that, you know, ChatGPT is the most used voice assistant or chatbot that we use? Is it going to be that Amazon's able to partner with somebody else and take Alexa to the next level? Because I know that the voice assistant race, 85 million people use Google Assistant, 81 million folks, just fewer, use Apple Siri, 74 million people in America, this is, use Amazon Alexa. Those numbers are all growing a little bit going forwards. ChatGPT, over 100 million users was the headline that it managed to get in just 5 days. So what does a voice look like in terms of these different players in the next year or two?
Well, I mean, right now, ChatGPT is not a voice player since it is text-based.
Mm-hmm.
But we're going to see a huge evolution into this area in the next couple of years. Every one of these companies is looking at using much more advanced language models than they currently use to make voice a lot more useful. Mm-hmm. So right now, voice, people who use Alexa or Siri talk to their speakers, they're mostly using it to have it do functions, you know, turn on the lights, set my playlist. Maybe if they're on their mobile phone for Siri or Google Assistant, they'll ask it for directions to a nearby place. Mm-hmm. It's used for very simple tasks.
Set a timer, something like that.
Yeah. So, but, you know, what happens when you get these really advanced language models you can really speak with? What are the possibilities to open up then? It's pretty exciting and still to be determined.
Do we know when voice is coming to ChatGPT?
I mean, OpenAI has a voice program, which I'm sure they could pair with ChatGPT. So I think it's just a matter of time before something like that happens.
Okay. So that is the next evolution. That is something that they're probably most likely going
to
do.
Yeah, for sure. To be clear, I think Alexa's big competition is still going to be Google Assistant and Siri, and particularly Google Assistant, I think, because they have Google has such a presence in cars, also on TVs.
Mm-hmm.
Amazon has long dominated the smart speaker, the home speaker realm, but Google is really strong in these other areas, and I think that's where you're going to see the explosion of use in voice assistants, and of course in Android phones and on iPhones for Siri.
Okay. The explosion of use is going to be in what exactly? Sorry?
Well, just more advanced use cases for these voice assistants where you can really sort of interact with them in a way, not just to turn on things, but to ask them serious questions and get serious answers.
Okay. And so final question before we move to the TV portion of this conversation. I mean, in a year's time, what am I speaking to these voice assistants about? Like what kind of killer apps or use cases do you see being most prevalent?
Amazon's original vision for Alexa might finally be possible in the sense that people will use it for product search or things they want to, you know, tell me what's the highest rank downhill ski for icy conditions. Really complicated questions and give you really specific answers. It's not, you know, if you played around with ChatGPT, you're going to get funky answers right now. But all of these large language models will develop in the next couple of years and you're going to get really precise answers. So I think that's going to be a killer app. And then there are all other types of things that we can't even imagine now.
Yeah.
Automated advice apps. Who knows what else? So.
Do you imagine voice being paired with a visual component though? Because I always think that one of the things that's holding back voice is the fact that if I ask a question, I want to see some kind of visual with regards to the results. And so smart speakers that came with a screen, like the Echo Show, that always made more sense to me, especially if I'm in the living room and I'm speaking to my TV, which happens to be a smart speaker, let's pretend, or has a voice component. And I can say, where is the nearest coffee shop? Or I can say, pull up some of the latest microphone options for podcasting, and I can see the different options and then a way basically to kind of navigate through your results.
For sure. I think it's that combination of voice and visual that will make it a lot more powerful in a lot of ways. And something that's going to supercharge that is TV. Once you start connecting voice to the TV, or not once, it's already connected, but once you really start supercharging it, then it could really have a lot of possibilities there.
So let's round out the first half by talking about the TV, because you write the section in the report on Fire TV, which is Amazon's connected TV play. What are two stats to you, Yuri, that underscore Fire TV's significance?
So yeah, I mean, I think there are two things that show how important it is. First of all, 109.6 million, and that's the number of people in the US that use a Fire TV. Now, when I say use a Fire TV, that's a TV that has become a connected TV, either through a Fire TV stick or cube, or a directly built-in system that is, you know, that is using the Fire TV operating system. So 109.6 million people in the US have a system using Fire TV. So that's just a huge percentage there.
And that's, I mean, Roku's going to be their biggest competitor there. Behind Roku, just ahead?
It is actually behind Roku. That's right.
Just
behind, second place behind Roku.
Okay.
In the US. And then the second number is 21%. And that's 21% of CTV ads in the second half of 2022 ran via Fire TV. Again, that's second behind Roku at 49%. So Amazon is still trailing Roku in the CTV area. But I think it's a huge area of growth, not just for Amazon, but for advertising in general.
Right. And that's the US. You were noting in your report that the picture across the pond in Europe, advertising-wise, is quite different.
That's right. Yeah. In Europe, Fire TV's share of advertising is even higher than in the US at 34%, and it leads there. So what they've done in Europe, they want to replicate in the US. They're already the leader in Europe.
Yeah. Terrific. Well, that's all we've got time for talking about Amazon's voice and TV-related initiatives. We're going to talk in the second half about what they're up to in payments. Yuri, thank you so much for taking some time to hang out with me and the listeners today.
Always a pleasure, Marcus.
Yes, sir. Well, that was the first half of the show. Now we begin the second half of the show, and we're talking to two different folks. One of them is one of our senior analysts covering payments based out of New York. It's Grace Broadbent, ladies and gentlemen.
Hello there.
Hello there, Grace. Welcome to the show. We're also joined by principal analyst covering payments and demographics based out of Illinois. It's David Morris.
Hello, hello. Good to see you, Marcus.
Hello, sir. You too. Grace didn't say that, but we'll
it is wonderful to see you, Marcus. No,
it's too late for that. It's fine. She's just like, all right, let's get this over with, Marcus, please. I do a fact of the day at the top of the show, but I have facts for you guys as well, because Yuri is based in New Jersey. I had a New Jersey-related fact, and so I have facts related to, well, actually, now I'm just realizing, Grace, yours isn't based on where you are based. It is based on where you are from, which is Georgia.
Okay, so let's do it.
Why Georgia is called the Peach State. So this has got some history here. So Franciscan monks introduced peaches to St. Simon's and Cumberland Island in the 16th century. And then Cherokee Native Americans grew peaches in Georgia in the 18th century. And then because Georgia produces peaches and has some good ones, they're also kind of known as the Peach State. However, they're not the biggest producer of peaches. They used to be. Oh, you knew this.
South Carolina.
Is second. Who's first?
South Carolina's first.
No, it's
Georgia's
not.
Second.
Wait, is it? I've got California.
Oh, maybe.
Interesting.
What do you mean, maybe?
I don't know. I've always
discredit my fact of the day and you're kind of sure?
I went to college in South Carolina, and everyone in South Carolina is very proud of their peaches.
Oh, so this,
even
okay,
more
this
so
is
than
biased.
Georgia.
Okay, of course they're going to say, well, they're not. Maybe they were at some point, but today it's California. Yeah, they produce 19 times as many as Georgia.
Wow.
Huh? Yep. So that's Georgia. David, your turn. So I thought to myself, well, David's based in Illinois. What's produced in Illinois? David, do you know something that is quite unique to the state of Illinois? It's the number one producer of this thing in the country.
Do I know it?
I'll give you a hint. October 31st.
Halloween candy. Oh, candy.
No, that's
chocolate.
A good guess though. That was a bad hint. Pumpkins. Illinois is the largest producer of pumpkins in the country, harvesting more than twice as many pumpkin acres as any of the other top states.
It's fascinating. Wow.
Yeah. You only get the good stuff here on... it's the best I could find, okay? Illinois.
Yeah, I thought it would be candy. I mean, Chicago used to be the candy capital of the world. It's not anymore. But
really?
No.
Yeah.
Okay.
Tons of candy companies here. They're out of business or they've been bought up.
Okay. Popcorn too, right? It's the popcorn capital of somewhere.
I mean, you know, honestly, I never know anything that's going on locally. I didn't know the Cubs were any good the year they won the World Series until they were in the pennant.
Oh my God.
And I live here.
The worst Chicagoan.
I know payments, Marcus. That's what I do, payments.
Oh, well, luckily we're talking about that today. So let's get into it. We're talking about Amazon and everything payments related. So as we mentioned, Amazon does a lot of stuff. They do some online shopping things. They do some cloud service things. They do some advertising, healthcare, gaming. And we just talked about what they do with voice and TV. And now we've got David and Grace on to talk to us about payments. What are they up to? Well, one of the things that they've been doing is working on the Just Walk Out technology. That's where you go into a store, an Amazon Go store, for example, and you pick stuff up off the shelves and you walk out and it charges your credit card because you've scanned in when you walked through a door. And so, Grace, you writing this chapter for us, you write that Amazon is cutting back, though, on its ambitious goals for Just Walk Out technology, this including closing some of its cashierless stores. It seemed like quite a big push into this when it first got off the ground. How come? Why this step back?
Yes. So they are stepping back from their like first party stores. So the cashierless Go stores, the Amazon Fresh stores, integrating into Whole Foods. It's extremely expensive technology and very hard to scale. Mm. So instead of that, they are pivoting to licensing the technology to third-party retailers.
Okay.
So instead of building it out internally, they're building it out through third parties.
So are third parties going to, if it's expensive and it's hard to scale, is this just because Amazon doesn't have a massive grocery footprint? Is that the reason? Because if Amazon can't afford it, then I'm surprised that this is a technology that others will be able to rent from them.
So they are going to very like niche, smaller use cases. So instead of the giant grocery stores, some of the examples are like stores on college campuses or little convenience stores in airports or even like theme park concessions, which sounds large as a theme park, but just like little food stands and things of that nature.
I mean, it's really fascinating, Grace. I mean, that, you know, they've really push back on this. And I think the licensing play is actually interesting. I think they've housed that through AWS. So they're even putting it under an entirely different framework. And I think that there's may make more sense to place the technology underneath, you know, what they do with Amazon Web Services. I don't know that that's going to necessarily solve the problem of uptake either. But I think it's a way for them to be able to continue to try and utilize this technology to get information. You know, this isn't just about convenience for customers. It's about getting information about them. So I know they're going to continue to try.
Yeah. So speaking of continuing to try, to kind of wrap up talking about Just Walk Out technology, you know that Amazon's closed 9 of its cashierless Go stores, so there are about 20 left. The tech is still used in 40 Fresh stores, 2 Whole Foods stores. Are they going to wind down using this technology across their portfolio of stores completely at some point? Are they going to stick it out with these few stores? Do you see them ramping it up in the future? What's the play in terms of using this technology for themselves?
Right now, the path isn't clear, but based on what they are doing, it seems like they are scaling back everything, going to fully ramp it down for their internal stores.
Okay.
They have, a lot of those closures have just happened in the past year. And while they haven't announced any future plans, they definitely aren't expanding it. And I don't think it'd be out of the question to close these other stores.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Because to David's point, they are losing a lot of potential data about customers by not rolling this technology out across a ton of stores themselves. However, they are finding alternative ways to offer folks the chance to pay for things. So one of them is Amazon One. So this is where you pay for things by waving your palm over a reader. And it's growing, but you know it's still small scale. So Amazon One is available, you say, at roughly 400 locations across the US. The tech isn't necessarily driving significant sales, though. You were pointing out that the average location featuring Amazon One has seen it used only 7,500 times. So, Grace, what's holding Amazon One back?
I think there's two main things. The first is consumer adoption and security concerns preventing consumers from the adoption. Mm-hmm. There was a recent survey from Civic Science. That was very interesting. It says 73% of U.S. adults are not at all comfortable with Amazon's biometric payments in 2023. So that's the vast majority of people are not comfortable with it.
Wow.
And this is only slightly improving. It was at 78% in 2019 that were uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. So while it's declining at a very small rate.
And so that's interesting because that research, you pair that against this research from Payments and Intersect that we're asking consumers their preferred select authentication method. Do you prefer to authenticate who you are with a PIN code, a multi-factor, a password, a one-time password, biometrics? And biometrics was actually far and away the thing that most people preferred. Now that it's probably because if you got your smartphone, you can just press your thumb or your finger onto your smartphone and it unlocks it for you, or it reads your face. And so it's much more personal in terms of using your biometrics, that as opposed to kind of waving your hand around or something out in public reading your face. But that surprised me that folks weren't comfortable using it out in the wild, but were comfortable using biometrics to pay for things when it came to accessing their own smartphone.
I think that's a great point. I mean, I think that there's some education on the part of consumers that's probably in process with a technology like this. Mm-hmm. And, you know, long term, I mean, even in the short term, I think there could be a ramp of acceptance of this technology, and that it wouldn't necessarily be the consumer and the consumer concerns holding it back. I think it would actually become the Amazon, you know, competition rationale. Mm-hmm. I don't know what you think, Grace.
Well, I also think there's like almost a lack of trust in Amazon that's also holding it back. Amazon has kind of a reputation of being like the big bad retailer that has all our data and taking over the world. And so I do think there's hesitancy in giving Amazon additional data into us, whether that is the case, whether that should be the case. I mean, Apple has a ton of data on us as well. So I don't know if that's a rational case, but I do think that is inhibiting customers.
So if you had to guess, folks, real quick before we move to another section here, is do you think that people paying for things with their hands or with their faces out in grocery stores is going to be a thing we're going to see? And it's Amazon, the Amazon brand, that's maybe holding it back? Or is this just something that people aren't too bothered about doing and they're happy to pull their phone out and just use Apple Pay, Android Pay, Google Pay, Samsung Pay?
I think it can take off. I just think it's going to take longer than Amazon or other biometric providers would like it to take off at.
Okay.
For example, it took a really long time for mobile wallet usage to pick up, just paying with our phones. It really took the pandemic to spark widespread usage.
Yep.
And hopefully we'll have something else other than another pandemic to spur this. But I do think eventually, when people start getting more used to it, when it's everywhere, when people realize it's kind of the same as just opening your phone with your face, I do think it can take off. I just don't think it's going to be as quick as Amazon wants it to be.
Yeah. David, let's move to another area of Amazon's payment strategy, which is Amazon Pay. Let's start by explaining what that means.
Sure. Well, Amazon Pay is, I think the way to explain Amazon Pay is to actually explain a competitor that people would be more likely to know, and that's PayPal. The PayPal buy button, it's ubiquitous. It's all over the internet. You know, anywhere you go, there's a checkout option, and it's PayPal. Mm-hmm. Amazon Pay has that same offering. It has had that same offering for some time, but it's been held back from an adoption standpoint because, you know, I think piggybacking on some of what Grace said, I mean, Amazon is the big bad wolf of retail. And why would another retail want to partner with Amazon on something like this? You know, that's thematic, I think, throughout all of the technologies that we're talking about today.
Right. And it's interesting though, because you write that you're spot on. Why would you want to partner with the giant in your same space? But you write that the Amazon Pay solution is gaining steam via partnership. So what's changed and how is this looking going forward?
I think what has changed, I think the general competitive onus on not partnering with Amazon has not necessarily changed. But what has is, you know, you have Amazon being able to create this third-party marketplace of sellers, right? Mm-hmm. And those sellers are smaller to mid-sized businesses. They don't have the same dog in the hunt when it comes to competing with Amazon. They use Amazon to sell. And that's why you've got an uptick in adoption among those sellers. And the more recent partnership that I think is really interesting is the one that they've done with BigCommerce. Now, people may not know BigCommerce because they're a little smaller than a company that they may know, and that's Shopify. They're very similar in many ways. And the bottom line is that these companies are also serving those small to mid-sized businesses. And guess what? BigCommerce, if it wants to adopt something like Amazon Pay and allow its customers to use it, it ends up being able to better compete with Shopify, which has Shop Pay, another checkout button. It's kind of, you know, follow whack-a-mole, follow the checkout buttons, Marcus.
Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah.
Well, that's what we've got time for, unfortunately, with regards to Amazon and what they're up to in every possible space imaginable. The full report is called The Power of Amazon in 2023. What's next for the Titan's 19 business divisions, with contributions in that report from 10 different analysts, three of whom we spoke to today. Thank you so much to my guest. Thank you to David for hanging out today.
Yeah, good. Great to see you. Grace, always a pleasure.
Thank you to Grace.
Yes, thank you. It's been wonderful.
Yes, indeed. Thank you to Yuri, who joined us in the first half. Thank you to all the analysts who contributed to the report we were talking about today. Thanks to Victoria, who edits the show, James, who copy edits it, and Stuart, who runs the team. And thank you guys so much for listening into the Behind the Numbers Daily, an eMarketer podcast made possible by Awin. You can tune in tomorrow to hang out with host Sarah Lebo on the Reimagining Retail show, where she speaks to analysts Sky Canavis and Karina Perkins all about the toy market.